Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, February 10th, 2016. A top U.S. diplomat expresses her disappointment at the slow progress of implementing the August peace deal.
These leaders have to care about the impacts of this war on their people. And we can't care more than they care. This is high on our agenda, but in the meantime, what we're trying to do is address the humanitarian consequences.
And a lawmaker from the newly created Eastern Upper Nile State warns of a potential serious conflict over President Kiir's 28 states.
We hope that the Jing of Padang and their plotters understand it well, that illegal occupation of Malakal Town and Absalo area is not revoked. It would be a receipt for a non-stop deadly war.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan is at a breaking point. That is according to Linda Itim, USAID's Assistant Administrator for Africa. Itim joined Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the Secretary for Bureau of African Affairs, at a press conference this morning in Washington, where both agreed that the issue holding South Sudan back is lack of leadership. Ayen Bier has more from Washington.
As the U.S. Secretary of the Bureau of African Affairs, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, says her team, in tandem with the U.S. Office of the Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan, have been closely engaged in convincing the leaders of South Sudan to implement the peace deal. Thomas-Greenfield says the situation in South Sudan was high on the agenda at the recent AU summit in Addis Ababa. She adds several meetings between U.S. and South Sudanese officials were held on the sidelines of the AU summit, but the outcome did not yield much progress.
We were very disappointed at the responses that we got. It was very clear that the peace implementation is not being prioritized by the two sides. And we know that that is the answer to starting to address the humanitarian crisis that we see looming in South Sudan.
What South Sudan lacks, according to Thomas-Greenfield, is a lack of political will from President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar.
What we have said is that these leaders have to care about the impacts of this war on their people. And we can't care more than they care. So this is high on our agenda. But in the meantime, what we're trying to do is address the humanitarian consequences through an intense program.
USAID Assistant Administrator for Africa Linda Etem says South Sudan's man-made crisis is costing the U.S. government three times the amount compared to what it spent on the El Nino crisis in Ethiopia. The United States spent almost $1.5 billion to address the humanitarian crisis in South Sudan. Aid agencies project an additional $1.2 billion will be required this year.
We have been sending very strong messages to the leaders in South Sudan to say that we are right now at a breaking point and that for the sake of their people, they need to come up with some sort of political dispensation to allow humanitarian assistance to flow through.
Etim says laws like the recent NGO bill passed last week do more to restrict aid for those who need it most. Just this week, UN agencies warned of worsening conditions for millions of South Sudanese who are struggling to find food. Etem strongly condemned the NGO bill, which she says could threaten the ability for organizations like USAID to reach vulnerable South Sudanese. For VOA News, I'm Ayen Bior in Washington.
Linda Thomas-Greenfield is rather the Assistant Secretary for the Bureau of African Affairs at the U.S. State Department. Members of South Sudan's National Assembly from the Shuluk region of former Upper Nile State want the state governor of the newly created Eastern Nile State to reverse a recent decision to fire state employees. The lawmakers say the move to divide the country into 28 states should be postponed, including dismissal of state workers, to give peace a chance. Philip Thorn-Aleu reports for VOA from Juba.
President Salva Kiir divided the former Upper Nile into three states, Western Nile, Eastern Nile, and Lat Jor. Malakal has remained the headquarters of Eastern Nile, but lawmakers representing the Chuluk areas in Western Nile State say the historical town belongs to their ethnic group. MPs representing the Chuluk called a news conference this week to express their concerns. Onyoti Adigo, the minority leader in parliament, warned that if Malakal is annexed to Eastern Nile State, it will lead to conflict.
We hope that the Jing of Padang and their plotters understand it well, that if this illegal occupation of Malakal town and other areas, other Cholo areas, is not revoked, it would be a receipt for a non-stop deadly war, given the already broken social fabrics and coexistence that has been existing between Cholo and the Padang Dinka group.
A visible angry Adigo claims that Eastern Nile State officials issued a directive earlier this month dismissing staff who are now under the jurisdiction of the other two states. He called the action illegal.
And here I have a document of dismissing these people here, which was written by the so-called Secretary General of Eastern Nile State. And the subject said termination of service and transfer of all government employees from Eastern Nile State to Western Nile-led jurisdictions. So that is really is the one which is really very painful, that you terminate the service of people and then you say, go away.
Adigo says dividing the Poma Upper Nile State should not cause division among the people.
As South Sudanese, you can live anywhere you live. You can work anywhere you want to work, but not to dismiss people from the area where they are. It should have been an agreement between the three governors, the governor of East Bank, of Western Nile, and also led you to sit down and try to divide the human resources which belong to the former Upper Nile State. But these things did not happen.
Adigo says decisions like dismissing government personnel are not in the interest of peace.
That is why we said it would have been better for the government to make priorities. And the priority is peace. Peace is paramount. And not only peace, starvation in the country should have been addressed by the government, not dividing the country to 28 states.
Adigo says the government of Eastern Nile State should withdraw the order, reinstate the dismissed employees, and the three governors should get together and come up with a plan to share the human resources of Poma Upper Nile State. Governor of the newly Eastern Nile State, Choluthon, says the human resources of Greater Upper Nile was registered and divided among the three states.
Three governors sat down, and the committee that were registering the assets of the Poma Upper Nile State, we reached the conclusion that every state to receive the manpower that was there at Upper Nile State, because Upper Nile State is not any longer there. To my surprise, they don't know what was happening. So it was the implementation of the 28 states.
Son says the opposition MPs should consult their governor of Western Nile State before jumping to a conclusion. For VOA News, I am Philip Tona Leo in Juba.
Residents of Wau Town in the newly Wau State say a new community policing strategy has improved relations between police and the community. Police officials in the area say, unlike the past, many residents now report crimes to the police without fear of being implicated. Dimo Silva Aurelio has the story from Juba for VOA.
The United Nations Development Programme, UNDP, has trained the police and Wau residents to work together to reduce the crime rate. Residents were allowed to select representatives to be part of the community policing program, who meet regularly with police to discuss concerns and share information. Residents say in the past, some officers would detain citizens who reported criminal activity rather than investigate the reports. The residents say the training is making a difference. Now, residents call police directly when they suspect someone has committed a crime or is about to commit a crime. Teresa Ramadan, one of the community policing members, says crime in her area has dropped because residents help police track down criminals.
Actually, the relationship between the police and the community is improving every day because they are helping us not to fear them, to be friends with them and to give them information.
Speaking in Arabic, Hassan John says residents in his area are now more willing to share information with police. He says it wasn't always that way.
In the past, the police behavior was very bad and makes the citizens afraid. They used to bring people from army to police. They are not organized. But now, after the independence of South Sudan, the police are well trained. For example, now the last police batch that was recruited graduated from high school. But in the past, the police were not educated.
Police in Wau says, though on the surface the crime rate in the area seems to have increased, in practice the rate has dropped. They say citizens are simply reporting more crimes because they no longer fear the police and are aware of how to report crimes. Since October of last year, police say 100 cases of rape have been reported in Wau. Speaking in Arabic, James Anthony Kobo, a police officer in Wau, says despite efforts to have the police work in partnership with the community to combat crime, many residents still fear the police.
If a policeman comes to arrest a civilian, he takes up a stick or even denies information. This does not help us because we are supposed to cooperate so that everyone gets his or her right. Another thing is that most of the police do not understand the law.
While State Police Commissioner Major General Chol Tuch told community policing members who are attending 5 days of training that keeping the lines of communication open between the community and police will ease the work of officers.
Police work can only be effective where there is a consensus of community, that is, cooperation between community and police.
And Tuch says that is why he came to Wau, to tell police that they should do the things that fosters good relationship with residents so that police are seen as part of the community. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva, Aurelio in Wau.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at how the economic hardship is affecting one farmer in Kajokeji. That story when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Do you have a piece of jewelry that has a special meaning to you?
Yes, my wedding ring is very important. And that is very significant to me.
I don't really like pay attention to jewelry. I'm wearing one bird. It's not like my thing. I don't really pay attention to jewelry. I just know it should go with my dressing bird. I don't pay particular attention to jewelry.
I had one bead, you know, that was given to me by my grandmother. It was a traditional bead my grandmother gave me as a remembrance.
Yes, I do. I have a piece of jewelry, like my chain, it has my name. So my chain has my name and it's made of gold. Don't put it on all the time because it's very risky moving with it on the roadside.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. We now turn to South Africa, where a new Afrobarometer survey shows a decline in support for democracy in the country amid growing discontent in how it's being implemented. Multiracial democracy began in 1994, but despite promise and hope, the country in recent years has faced political turmoil, high unemployment, corruption and scandals, and a lack of basic services. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Afrobarometer conducted its survey of South Africans between August and September of last year. Sibusi Sangomo is the organization's communications coordinator for Southern Africa.
We looked at democracy this time around, and we found that South Africans have actually grown more dissatisfied with the state of the country's democracy in general. The outright support for democracy has actually declined from 2011, and a majority of citizens are actually saying that they'd be willing to give up elections in favor of a non-elected government that would provide basic services.
Besides being dissatisfied with how democracy has been implemented, Ngomo says they're not very happy with their leaders either.
People are basically disappointed and disapprove across the board, from the president down to local councillors and members of parliament.
One of the recent scandals involves President Jacob Zuma spending $20 million for upgrades at one of his residences. The Afrobarometer official quotes former U.S. President Bill Clinton, who defined the main issue in his campaign by saying, "It's the economy, stupid."
That's where the issue is. and the economy is not being doing well. The service levels that people have been receiving, remember we had an electricity crisis for some time last year and the year before that. So those things are having an impact because people in South Africa are associating and have always associated to a certain extent that democracy will bring good things for the people in the country, including services.
For example, he says, someone living in a shack in a township, long without electricity or running water, may wonder how important his or her vote is.
Those things will tell me, well, maybe the system is not working because I go and vote every 5 years, but what has changed? Well, there has been change, but I don't think it's gone far enough. But also, people are now looking at the quality of service that they receive. So, for instance, somebody can have access to water, but they might have to share a tap with 10 other people.
The Afrobarometer survey also shows fewer people are going to vote on election days. Ngoma says opinions on democracy in South Africa varied among demographic groups.
The support for it is higher on average amongst people who are actually better educated, who are rural, who are younger and black. When we look at alternatives to democracy, for instance, South Africans in general will tell you they don't want one man rule, they don't want to return to apartheid, one party rule or military rule. But the most interesting finding we got was that 44% of white South Africans reject a hypothetical return to apartheid, but 30% would support such an initiative, and another 26% are ambivalent, or they said they don't know.
The survey shows only 49% of white South Africans support democracy. Ngomo calls those findings worrying. The figure is higher among those who are mixed race, 57%. Some 56% of Indian and South Asians in the country support democracy. Percentages are much higher among black South Africans. When asked about migrants and asylum seekers, whites and the opposition Democratic Alliance Party were more likely to block their entry into the country. Ruling ANC party supporters favored it. However, support for the ANC itself has declined among Indians and mixed-race voters. The Afrobarometer Communications Coordinator says the survey results could reflect growing pains in a still young democracy. But he says people are expressing themselves, and that's a good thing for democracy. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
And we go back to Juba. It's been more than a month since South Sudan's central bank devalued the country's currency, and many citizens say life has become extremely difficult as prices of food commodities go up. They say the price hikes are making it nearly impossible to afford basic necessities like food. Mungome Debs Rakarinj has more for VOA from Juba.
28-year-old Juba resident Florence Ochan is doing her laundry as her child and niece play nearby. Ochan says when she first arrived in Juba from her little home in Magu County last year, she took a job as saleswoman in a local supermarket. She says her salary then was 1,500 South Sudanese pounds a month, enough to support her and her 9-year-old daughter. And she says she was able to feed her family on beef at least 3 times a month. She says nowadays she forgoes her favorite dish and even times has to skip some meals because the prices of most consumer goods have doubled, if not tripled.
Food is expensive there. You may plan to buy beans, you may plan like buying 5 cups, you end up buying 2 cups. Charcoal, everything is expensive. Sugar is £20 a cup. If you come to cooking oil, the small bottle is at £20. The big one is 60. See? You can see the difference.
Ochan says tomatoes used to cost 5 South Sudanese pounds, but sell for more than 12 South Sudanese pounds. A bar of soap that previously cost 4 pounds now goes for 20 pounds. And the price of bottled water has risen by 300%. She says some people cannot afford to eat more than a meal a day.
Many people do not eat lunch supper. Some may decide to eat supper. They don't eat lunch. Some may decide to eat lunch, they don't eat supper. Because the cost of living has become too high. That's what I've seen.
In December last year, the South Sudan Central Bank devalued its currency by 84%. The central bank said it would allow the pound to trade freely by adopting a per black market rate of 18.5 from 2.96 against the US dollar. The dollar now sells between 29 and 32 pounds on the black market. According to a World Food Program report released last month, the devaluation of SSP has increased the price of imported goods as foreign suppliers require traders to pay goods in US dollars, prompting traders to charge more for their goods. 19-year-old single mother, Nancy John, says she makes and sells tea to earn a living. She says she has increased her tea prices because her costs are higher.
Everything is very expensive in the market. Many customers have run away because they say they don't have money. A day you end up selling 4 to 5 cups. No one wants to drink tea.
John says before the local currency was devalued, she used to earn a profit of at least £600 a month, which allowed her to send her 5-year-old to nursery school. Last month, she earned only 400 South Sudanese pounds, which she says is not enough to pay her daughter's tuition fees. Juba resident Emmanuel Lukudu Dennis Ladu says the unstable prices are very disturbing.
Things have been changing in day after day. The price of the border, which is called Bajaj, it is 35,000 pounds. And then the Senke, which is last year also have it with 4,000. Now it is 15,000.
James Alich Garang, a senior economist at the Juba-based Ebony Center for Strategic Studies, says the government should have put in place measures to protect people from the harsh impact of the high inflation rate.
Meaning there were supposed to be prerequisite, preconditioned, things that should have been done before the realignment.
The government recently announced a new salary structure for employees, with the first phase beginning this month. Alich says the government should adopt other long-term economic policies to reduce inflation. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, says it is disturbed by an increase in the number of livestock deaths across parts of South Sudan. The head of FAO in South Sudan says the conflict prevents veterinarians from reaching parts of the country, leading to the deaths of thousands of animals. VOA fellow Tito Justin reports from Washington.
The affected areas include Lier, Jongole, Eastern Equatoria, and some parts of Greater Upper Nile State. Serge Tissot, the head of FAO in South Sudan, says thousands of cows, sheep, and goats have died in recent months due to tropical diseases such as foot and mouth diseases and anthrax.
When you are in a good situation, you are always losing some animals. That's part of the life. You cannot have 100% success. When the situation is deteriorating due to security, due to the lack of access to vaccine, to the lack of access to also to water, lack of access to grass, of course you increase the risk. And that is the situation currently in South Sudan.
Tissot says his organization does not have data for the number of livestock in the country, but he says at least 15 to 20% of those animals have died since the conflict began in 2013. According to data released by the FAO in 2011, there were at least 11 million cattle and 19 million sheep and goats in South Sudan. Tissot says, as a result of the conflict, animals have limited grazing areas.
A lot of animals are outside the migration corridor, and they don't have access to feed at the right time. Now we are going to the dry season, and it may be difficult for some animals to have access to grass in time, and the general situation in those areas will go down.
Mading Mayom, a resident of Bor in Jonglei State, says he lost most of his 50 cows to unknown diseases. Mayom says this strange disease began killing his cattle 6 years ago.
For 3 years it died, beginning from 2009 up to now. Coming from the different kind of the disease, so like yellow fever and what they call about in the language is finished. Many people from 2009 up to now, and somebody don't have anything.
Mayom says Now that his cows are dead, his children and relatives have no source of food because they relied on the milk from his cows. Tissot says his organization and South Sudan's Minister of Health intend to vaccinate at least 5 million cows this year. But he says this is not enough.
Without to have peace implementation everywhere, it remains difficult to have access to all animals. And it's also important to say that animals must go back to the original location, to go back to grass and things like that. Where there is no grass anymore, it's difficult for animals to survive.
Majority of South Sudanese depend on livestock as source of food and wealth. The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, a tool used to measure the magnitude of food insecurity in countries, reported at least 2.8 million people, which is 25% of South Sudan's population, are in urgent need of food assistance. For VOA News, I am Tiro Justin in Washington.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. USAID Deputy Assistant Administrator for Africa, Linda Edom, said today that South Sudan is at a breaking point. Linda Thomas-Greenfield, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of African Affairs, also told reporters in Washington today that her team, in tandem with the U.S. Office of the Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan, have been trying to convince the leaders of South Sudan to implement the peace deal. Thomas-Greenfield says South Sudan was high on the agenda at the recent AU summit in Addis Ababa. She says she held several meetings with South Sudanese leaders on the sidelines of the summit, but little progress was made. Thomas-Greenfield says what South Sudan lacks is a political will from President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar to attain peace. Members of South Sudan's National Assembly from the Shilluk region of former Upper Nile State want the state governor of the newly created Eastern Nile State to reverse a recent decision to fire state employees. The lawmakers say the move to divide the country into 28 states should be halted, including the dismissal of state workers, in order to give peace a chance. President Kiir divided the former Upper Nile into three states, Western Nile, Eastern Nile, and Luatjor. Malakal has remained the headquarters of Eastern Nile, but lawmakers representing the Shilluk areas in Western Nile State say the historical town belongs to their ethnic group. MPs representing the Shilluk called a news conference to complain about the firings today. And finally, the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization says it's disturbed by an increase in the number of livestock deaths across parts of South Sudan. The head of the FAO in South Sudan says the conflict prevents veterinarians from reaching parts of the country, leading to the deaths of thousands of animals. The affected areas include Lir, Jungle A, Eastern Equatoria, and some parts of Greater Upper Nile State. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Ping Dal by Vivian. We've been listening to Vivian with that song in her native Shilluk language. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. We hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.